But Mrs. Brady seemed capable of extracting only so much pleasure from her new life of respectability. According to reports from friends and associates, the retired madam became increasingly morbid and religious over the next few years. Eventually, she spent $8,000 on an elaborate red marble tomb in Metairie Cemetery. Flanked by two imposing stone flambeaux, the miniature temple featured elegant carvings and bas-reliefs front and back. At the doors to the tomb stood a statue of a beautiful young woman carrying an armful of roses, her other hand placed against the door, as if in the act of pushing it open. Mrs. Brady had meanwhile decided to devote the rest of her life to the cultivation of her adored niece. "I am living only for Anna," she confided to a friend, and indeed, the two women were reportedly inseparable now. At one point, Mrs. Brady confessed that she would rue the day that Anna finally got married. When the girl asked why, her aunt said simply, "Because men are dogs." For a woman who'd spent her entire life catering to the carnal desires of thousands of men, the sentiment was perhaps understandable. But Anna was now in her mid-twenties. How much longer could even the most sheltered innocent be kept in ignorance of the basic facts of her own deceptively privileged life? By 1910, it had become clear that reformers generally, and Philip Werlein in particular, were not going to give up their campaign against Storyville. Their proposals to screen off the district and to move the Basin Street brothels had proven both unpopular and politically untenable. But now Werlein, armed with the provisions of the Gay Shattuck Law, decided to try a new tack. And it would center on the one issue about which moral reformers, business reformers, and machine politicians were all of one mind: race. "The one thing that all Southerners agree upon is the necessity of preserving our racial purity," Werlein told reporters in early February. "The open association of white men and Negro women on Basin Street, which is now permitted by our authorities, should fill us with shame, as it fills the visitor from the North with amazement." In the Gay Shattuck Law, which forbade any alcohol purveyor from serving both blacks and whites in the same building, and in another 1908 law against interracial concubinage, Werlein thought he had the ammunition needed to abolish at least the so-called octoroon houses, and he was willing to use it. "I will enlist the aid of every minister in New Orleans," he vowed. "I am determined to arouse public sentiment against the awful conditions which exist. It is a shame and a disgrace that Negro dives like those of Emma Johnson, Willie Piazza, and Lulu White, whose infamy is linked abroad with the fair name of New Orleans, should be allowed to exist and to boldly stare respectable people in the face." His conclusion: "These resorts should be exterminated, and the negresses who run them driven from the city." The war against Storyville thus entered a new and particularly ugly stage. Until now, the district had been a lone holdout in the overall movement in New Orleans toward greater repression of African Americans. Black men had never been allowed to come to Storyville proper as brothel customers. Even the black crib prostitutes were available to whites only. But they had always been able to work, dance, and drink there. And certainly, sexual congress between white men and black women had not only been allowed, but actively encouraged and advertised. All of this, however, was to change over the next few years as reformers attempted to move the city closer to traditional Southern norms of racial regimentation. Life in Storyville, as both blacks and whites had known it, was about to change. But perhaps the greatest threat to the district would come not from those who wanted to destroy it, but rather from those who wanted to exploit it. For the remarkable success of Storyville had not gone unnoticed in the criminal underworlds in the rest of the country. A number of gangsters from places like New York and Chicago had been arriving in the Crescent City in recent years, eager to win their share of the bounty. One pair of brothers from New York, Abraham and Isidore Sapir, or Shapiro, alleged white slavers looking to expand their interests, seemed especially determined to shake up the status quo of Anderson County. Changing their names to Harry and Charles Parker, respectively, they came to New Orleans in the early years of the 20th century and opened a saloon on the corner of Liberty and Custom House Streets. In 1910, they sold that saloon and bought a dance hall on Franklin Street called the 101 Ranch, right behind Tom Anderson's annex. By all reports, they were not pleasant, easygoing fellows, like the mayor of Storyville, and they were apparently eager to show the local vice lords just how a tenderloin was supposed to be run. Chapter 13. An Incident on Franklin Street. When the Parker brothers first decided to get into the dance hall business in Storyville, their prospects for success were bright. A dance craze had been sweeping the country, and bold new steps like the bunny hug, the grizzly bear, and the turkey trot were becoming wildly popular, in New Orleans as in the rest of the nation. Local clergymen and blue stockings may have complained, pointing to provisions of the Gay Shattuck Law that were supposed to keep women, alcohol, and music strictly separated. But police enforcement had so far been lax. Business was good, and by 1910, numerous dance halls and cabarets had opened in Storyville, clustering mainly on and around Franklin Street, just one block behind the Basin Street brothels. The Parker's 101 Ranch quickly became one of the liveliest and most popular venues in the district, attracting crowds to hear some of the best black bands in the city. But the Parkers weren't satisfied. The competition for customers on Franklin Street was keen, and the brothers from New York were determined to eliminate some of their homegrown rivals. Their first target was John Peg Anstett, the popular one-legged proprietor of Anstett's Saloon, a place where many white musicians like Nick LaRocca came to hear the black bands. According to local gossip, in 1911, Charles Parker began spending time with Anstett's mistress, a prostitute named May Gilbert, hoping to convince her to swear out an affidavit accusing her lover of being engaged in the white slavery trade. When Anstett heard about this, he was enraged and responded, as one typically did in Storyville in 1911, by taking a pot shot at Parker one evening in a Franklin Street saloon. The bullet missed its mark, as did Parker's retaliatory shot at Anstett sometime later at another district dive. But although no one was hurt or arrested in the incident, it did make one thing clear. The power structure that had grown up in the district in its first decade of existence was about to be challenged. In 1912, the Parkers sold the 101 Ranch to William Phillips, a local restaurateur and friend of Peg Anstett's. Phillips renovated the building and reopened it as the 102 Ranch, a venue that soon became a popular gathering place for the city's horse players. Tom Anderson, still very much involved in the racing world, was said to occasionally take refuge at the 102 whenever he tired of the many tourists who came to his annex around the corner and insisted on seeing the great host. But the Parkers had not left the dance hall business. That same year, in fact, they opened the Tuxedo, almost directly across the street from the 102 Ranch, a move that was in direct violation of a clause in their sales agreement with Phillips. The new Tuxedo, moreover, was a large and modern entertainment complex, with a dime-a-dance section in the rear and a large bar up front that opened out directly onto Franklin Street. Soon, the Parkers were directly competing with Phillips for the best of the city's musical talent. Even so, Phillips, to the Parkers' annoyance, continued to attract a large share of the dance hall business. The rivals argued frequently, sometimes coming to blows in the street. The resulting brawls soon created lurid newspaper headlines that ended up hurting Storyville's reputation at a particularly inopportune time, just when reformers were looking for ammunition in their campaign to close the district. For New Orleans jazz men, however, the increasing competition among dance hall and cabaret operators was a boon, thanks to the ongoing dance craze, to which the revolutionary new sound proved especially conducive. Jazz was becoming increasingly popular, not just with the denizens of poor black neighborhoods, but among the city's white sporting set as well. Work was plentiful, and musicians were finally making enough money to give up their day jobs and play full-time. Clarinetist Alphonse Picou described a typical jazzman's schedule during these years. "I worked at my trade all week. All day Saturday, I would play in a wagon to advertise the dance that night, then I'd play all night. Next morning, we have to be at the depot at 7 o'clock to catch the train for the lake, play the picnic at the lake all day, come back and play a dance all Sunday night. Monday, we advertise for the Monday night ball and play that Monday night. Sometimes my clarinet seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds. By this time, most of the now storied venues of early New Orleans jazz were up and running. In 1910, Italian businessman Peter Chacho opened the Manhattan Cafe on Iberville. Universally known as Pete Lala's, the club was, according to one Storyville denizen, a noisy, brawling barn of a place, offering music and dancing downstairs, heavy gambling in the back rooms, and assignations upstairs. And it wasn't long before it became central to the city's jazz scene. Pete Lala's was the headquarters, pianist Clarence Williams would later recall, the place where all the bands would come when they got off work, and where the girls would come to meet their main men. They would come to drink and play and have breakfast and then go to bed. Trombonist Kid Ory, who finally moved full-time to New Orleans in 1910, managed to get his group a regular gig at Pete Lala's, and soon many of the other big names were playing there as well. Another Lala, John T. Lala, ran the Big 25 on Franklin just west of Iberville, which also became a noted hangout for musicians and gamblers. It was where, according to Louis Armstrong, all the big-time pimps and hustlers would congregate and play cotch. The Frenchman's, a bit farther afield at the corner of Villery and Bienville, was a particular favorite of the district's piano professors. According to Jelly Roll Morton, who by this time was spending most of his time away from New Orleans, the Frenchman's was the most famous night spot after everything else was closed. It was only a back room, but it was where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off work in the sporting houses. About 4 a.m., they would go to the Frenchman's, and there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. Storyville's reputation as the birthplace of jazz has often been exaggerated. Black Storyville across Canal Street actually has a better claim. But the district can definitely take credit for nurturing the new music's childhood and adolescence. Keppard, McKay, Ory, Bunk Johnson, and other members of the post-Bolden generation were now making music history nightly in the dance halls and clubs of Storyville, though few people at the time, including the musicians themselves, realized this, given the character of the venues they played in. "My first job was in Billy Phillips' place," trumpeter Mutt Carey would later recall. "We played anything we pleased in that joint. You see, there was no class in those places. All they wanted was continuous music. Man, they had some rough places in Storyville in those days. A guy would see everything in those joints, and it was all dirty. It was really a hell of a place to work." Meanwhile, the music was changing as new star soloists rose to take up the mantle left behind by Buddy Bolden. For some years after Bolden's institutionalization, Creole trumpeter Freddie Keppert was widely regarded as his principal heir. "After Buddy died," Sidney Bechet would later write, forgetting that Bolden didn't actually die until much later, "Freddie Keppert was king. Freddie kind of took Buddy's way some. He played practically the same way as Buddy, but he played. He really played." In the intensely competitive environment of New Orleans music, however, there was always someone new coming up, eager to snatch the coveted title for himself. Cornetist Joe Oliver, an uptown African-American who, like Bolden, lacked some of the downtown polish of his Creole peers, rose to prominence in these years. Though several years older than Keppard, he came to music somewhat later. He began his career around 1910 with the Eagle Brass Band, the new name for Bolden's old outfit. Soon he was also playing the better clubs of the district, 102 Ranch, Pete Lala's, and wowing audiences with his driving freak style, using various mutes to make his horn sound like everything from a rooster to a baby. "How he could make it talk," one fellow player marveled. One famous night at Aberdeen's in the district, Oliver decided to stake his claim. To hear one version of the story, "Something got into Joe one night as he sat quietly in the corner and listened to the musicians who were praising Freddie Keppard and Manuel Perez. He was infuriated by their tiresome adulation. Didn't they know that Joe Oliver could play a cornet too? So he came forth from his silence, strode to the piano, and said, 'Jones, beat it out in B flat.' Jones began to beat, and Joe began to blow. The notes tore out clear as a bell, crisp and clean. He played as he never had before, filling the little dance hall with low, throbbing blues. Jones backed him with a slow, steady beat. With this rhythm behind him, Joe walked straight through the hall, out onto the sidewalk. There was no mistaking what he meant when he pointed his cornet, first towards Pete Lala's, where Keppard was playing, then directly across the street to where Perez was working. A few hot blasts brought crowds out of both joints. They saw Joe Oliver on the sidewalk, playing as if he would blow down every house on the street. Soon every rat hole and crib down the line was deserted by its patrons, who came running up to Joe, bewitched by his cornet. When the last joint had poured out its crew, he turned around and led the crowd into Aberdeen's, where he walked to the stand, breathless, excited, and opened his mouth wide to let out the big, important words that were boiling in his head. But all he could say was, "There, that'll show 'em." After that night, they never called him anything but King Oliver. Actually, there's no evidence that anyone called him King until he went to Chicago some years later, but Oliver's importance to New Orleans music in the teens would be difficult to exaggerate. He was especially influential among the younger generation of players just coming into their own. In this time of musical ferment, bands shuffled personnel frequently, so neophytes would eventually get the chance to play with many of the older players they admired. Sidney Bechet, for instance, was now playing with a number of different ensembles all over town, despite the fact that he was still in his mid-teens. Hoping to discipline their wild child, his conservative Creole parents would sometimes lock up his clarinet in a cabinet, but Sidney would just go to his gig anyway, asking his band leader to get him any old pawn shop clarinet. Often, when he was supposed to be playing with his brother's somewhat staid Silver Bells band, Sidney would gig instead with his own band, formed with his friend Buddy Pettit, called the Young Olympians. "I'd always catch hell from my brother when he'd find I was playing in the Olympians," Bechet would later recall. "Many a time he'd come to catch me at it and drag me off. I didn't care to have trouble with my brother, but it was like I couldn't help myself. There was so much more of what I was looking for in other bands, so much more of what I was needing." Even Bechet's most admired mentors had trouble keeping the young clarinetist under control. "We could never keep our hands on that Sidney," remembered Louis Nelson, who played with his former protege in several venues around town. "Regular little devil, always running off down the alley after them little women." So eager was Bechet to be perceived as a ladies' man that he once pretended to have VD by pouring Mustrol ointment over his crotch and then wrapping it up in a bandage. Sometime later, he tried to take credit for impregnating a neighborhood girl. "I'm sure I can support a wife," he told the girl's father one night. "I earn 75 cents or $1 a night in the district." The two of them drank wine and talked it over all night, until the father, who knew exactly who it was who'd made his daughter pregnant, carried the sleeping boy back to his family's house and put him to bed. The final break with his family, though, came in 1913, when Sidney was 16 or 17. Whether he was kicked out or just decided to move himself out, he left the Bechet residence for good and relocated uptown. And that's when he really started to get into trouble. "One night, we ended up in jail together," the bassist Pops Foster recalled. "Sidney was fooling around with a chick at a dance out at the lake. She pulled a knife and stabbed him. I grabbed a stick and started after her. When the cops came, we told them we were just playing. They took us to jail and then let us go. When we got back to the dance, she thanked us for not getting her in trouble. Sidney was always wanting to fight, but the fights, never came off." But it was certainly not difficult for a young black man to find trouble for himself in New Orleans at this time. The perception among white New Orleanians was that the city's black residents, in the decade after the Robert Charles riot and the rise of Jim Crow, had become defiant and more assertive than ever before. This was especially true at Mardi Gras time, when blacks who formerly celebrated in their own neighborhoods began to invade white residential areas in their revels. Sometimes the results were violent, as during the 1908 carnival, when a group of Mardi Gras Indians, young members of a black crew masking as Indians, engaged in a melee on Burgundy Street with a group of white youths. The next year, the Times Democrat complained about black spectators at a parade in the Central Business District. The objectionable feature was the manner in which the Negroes elbowed and shoved their way through the crowds to get in the front row, the paper observed. Complaints were many, especially from women and children, who were powerless to hold their places. The change in demeanor of the Negro crowds was strongly remarked by nearly everyone. By 1911, the alleged problem had reached the notice of even J. Benjamin Lawrence, the Baptist preacher who had targeted Tom Anderson the year before. Speaking to his congregation on the Sunday after Mardi Gras, he took special note of the aggressiveness of the black revelers. "I went carefully up one side and down the other of Canal Street," he told his flock, "and from St. Charles Street up, I found Negroes occupying the front places almost wholly. I also noticed two or three Negroes to every white person. Big black Negro men were pushing themselves through the crowd and pressing in upon white women in a manner to make a white man's blood boil." Police efforts to maintain order at parades and other public events often amounted to arresting many of the black males present. And the arrests often included those who were busy providing the entertainment. Rare was the New Orleans jazz man who hadn't spent at least one night sitting up in some precinct lockup after a gig that had somehow gotten out of hand. Louis Armstrong, still a young boy at this time, was no stranger to the volatile racial atmosphere of New Orleans in the early teens. Born on August 4, 1901, to a 15-year-old mother in a tough area of the city known as the Battlefield, he grew up among the pimps, thieves, and prostitutes of a neighborhood frequently targeted by police in their peacekeeping efforts. "I seen everything from a child growing up," Armstrong would later remark. "Nothing happened I ain't never seen before." His was anything but a sheltered childhood. His parents separated when he was still very young. His father, Willie, had run off with another woman, leaving Louis's mother, May Ann, to fend for herself and her baby alone. Overwhelmed, May Ann, who was little more than a child herself, turned Louis over to his paternal grandmother, Josephine. May Ann then moved into the area known as Black Storyville, where quite likely she worked as a prostitute to make ends meet. Josephine, meanwhile, tried her best to keep Louis away from the criminal elements in the Battlefield, making sure he went to church and Sunday school every week. When necessary, she would discipline him with switches that she made him cut himself from a china ball tree growing in their front yard. This kind of living arrangement was not particularly unusual in the black New Orleans of the day, where grandparents often played the role of surrogate parents to young children. And Louis would later recall this part of his childhood in mostly positive terms. But an elderly widow could presumably do only so much to nurture an energetic young boy in such an environment. When he was about 5, Louis learned that his parents had reunited, at least long enough to give birth to another child. But by the time he got to meet his baby sister, his father had again abandoned his family. "Busy chasing chippies," as Armstrong would bitterly recall. Sometime in 1906, a friend of his mother's appeared at Josephine Armstrong's house and told the old woman that May Ann was sick and needed Louis back to care for her. Josephine packed up the boy's things and tearfully sent him off to Black Storyville with the friend. To get there, they had to ride the 2-lane avenue streetcar. That ride gave Louis his first and most vivid taste of the segregated place New Orleans had become. As he would later write, "It was my first experience with Jim Crow. I was just 5, and I had never ridden on a streetcar before. Since I was the first to get on, I walked right up to the front of the car without noticing the signs on the backs of the seats on both sides, which read, 'For colored passengers only.' Thinking the woman was following me, I sat down in one of the front seats. However, she did not join me, and when I turned to see what had happened, I saw her waving to me frantically. 'Come here, boy,' she cried. 'Sit where you belong.'" Over the next years, young Louis would learn just how disgustingly segregated and prejudiced his hometown truly was. But for the moment, he was just happy to be reunited with his mother and new baby sister. May Ann, still only 20 years old, tried to make amends. "I realize I have not done what I should by you," she told him when he first returned. "But son, Mama will make it up to you." And she did, to the best of her ability, given the circumstances. She enrolled Louis in the nearby Fisk School, kept him and his sister fed on red beans and rice, and doctored them with the natural laxatives that Armstrong would swear by as a cure-all for the rest of his life. Louis and Mama Lucy, as his young sister came to be called, had to deal with a series of stepfathers who shared their mother's bed, sometimes noisily, in the small one-room house on Perdido. Some of these men were pleasanter than others. A few of them fought bitterly with Mayanne, and one even struck her in the face one day and knocked her into the old Basin Canal. But even the kinder ones were no substitute for a loving father. Left largely to his own devices, young Louis tried to help out by selling newspapers, running errands, and selling overripe produce he found on the streets. He was no angel, certainly, and before long he was also bringing home his winnings from street games of craps, coon can, and blackjack. "I got to be a pretty slick player," he once admitted. But for all of his rough edges, he was a good-hearted, likable boy. Soon even the neighborhood bullies, whom he handled with a canny mixture of fearlessness, generosity, and respect, were looking out for the boy, rather than beating him up. There was, of course, no money in the household for anything like music lessons. "In those days," he would later quip, "I did not know a horn from a comb." But he was soon learning the basics, as Bolden and many others had, from the street peddlers, advertising wagons, and parade bands that abounded in the city in those days. Working on a junk wagon for a Jewish family who lived in the neighborhood, the Karnofskys, who would eventually become like a second family to the boy, he got a chance to blow a little tin horn for himself, summoning children to bring their old rags and bottles for purchase. And when he got a little older, he formed a vocal quartet with some friends and began singing for coins on the streets of Storyville. Little Louis got his first potential break in music at the age of 11, when Bunk Johnson heard the quartet singing in an amateur contest. The trumpeter liked their sound and told his bandmate Sidney Bechet about them. Bechet, who was only 15 himself at the time, went to hear the quartet and was equally impressed. "I got to like Louis a whole lot. He was damn nice," Bechet later wrote. "One time, a little after I started going to hear this quartet, I ran into Louis on the street and I asked him home for dinner. I wanted him and the quartet to come around so my family could hear them." But Louis seemed reluctant to make the long trip downtown. "Look, Sidney," the boy said, "I don't have any shoes. These I got, they won't get me there." Sidney ended up giving him 50 cents to get his shoes fixed and made him promise to come. Louis took the money, but then never showed up to perform. 48 years later, Bechet was still annoyed. "It's a little thing," he confessed in his 1960 autobiography, "but there's big things around it." Apparently, the common enemy of Jim Crow had not yet eliminated all of the traditional friction between downtown Creoles and uptown blacks. Then again, maybe little Louis just forgot. It ultimately took a brush with the law to propel Armstrong into the mainstream of New Orleans music, though at first the incident seemed like a setback. On December 31, 1912, Louis was preparing to do some New Year's celebrating. He found one of his stepfather's pistols in a cedar trunk, filled it with blanks, and brought it with him when his quartet set out to perform that night in Storyville. As the boys were making their way up Rampart Street, another kid from the neighborhood began shooting a cap gun at them. Knowing he could top this, Louis pulled the pistol from his belt and started shooting back. The policeman standing nearby was not amused. He grabbed the boy and dragged him to jail, where he spent what must have been the most frightening and unpleasant New Year's Eve he'd ever experienced. The next day, he was brought before a judge in the juvenile court. The verdict? Incarceration in the Colored Waifs Home for Boys for an indefinite term. It would prove to be the best piece of luck in Louis Armstrong's entire life. When the Parker brothers first ventured into the dance hall business on Franklin Street, they were not the only outsiders moving in on what had widely been regarded as Tom Anderson's turf. The city's Italian underworld had also seen the profit potential of business in and around Storyville, and they did not hesitate to claim a share for themselves. To state that the mafia moved in on Storyville would be inaccurate. Most serious crime historians doubt that the Italian crime syndicates in New Orleans at this time were organized enough to justify the mafia title, no matter what the local newspapers might think. But it is true that many of the nightclubs, saloons, and dance halls of the city's entertainment districts were being taken over by Italians, and many of their surnames, Matranga, Segreta, Tonti, Chacho, were well known to police as prominent in the criminal doings of the city. It was as if the nemeses of the city's reformers were closing ranks. Italian criminals and black musicians were, in a sense, finding refuge in the bastion of the vice lords, that is, in Storyville. At the same time, the fallout of the LaManna kidnapping of 1907 seemed to have plunged the city's Italian underworld into disarray. Francesco Genova, regarded by police as the principal figure in the local mafia, had left town shortly after being released from jail in the LaManna case, never to return. Some believe that his young lieutenant, Paul De Cristino, was now in charge. But this succession of leadership was apparently not satisfactory to Giuseppe Morello up in New York. Sometime in 1908, the boss of bosses traveled to New Orleans for several days of meetings with local criminal leaders. The visit, which ended with Morello parading through the Italian quarter wearing a knotted red handkerchief on his head, a supposed mafia death sign, had several purposes. It did not go unnoticed in the press, for instance, that a prominent Italian hotelier was stabbed to death within hours of Morello's return to New York. But the meetings also seemed to signal a change in leadership within the local organization. A letter from Morello, under the pseudonym G. LaBella, to New Orleanian Vincenzo Morecci, dated November 15, 1909, and written in the flowery, ambiguous, falsely humble style of such missives, more than hints at the ongoing shakeup. "Dear friend," it began, "am in possession of your two letters, one that bears the date of the 5th, the other on the 10th of November. I understand the contents. In regard to being able to reorganize the family, I advise you all to do it, because it seems it is not right to stay without a king nor country. But I authorize you to convey to all, i.e. to everyone, my humble prayer and my weak opinion, but well understood, that those who are worthy and that wish to belong should belong. Those that do not wish to belong, let them go." The recipient of this letter, Vincenzo Morecci, was a native of Termini Imerese, Sicily. He had emigrated to New Orleans in 1885 and was now an inspector, or banana checker, for United Fruit. Regarded by the Daily Picayune as an Italian of the better class, he had actually been a prominent member of the Italian Vigilance Committee that had investigated the LaManna affair. But there was more to Morecci than the Picayune realized at the time, and this was to become obvious over the next several years. Late one Saturday night in March of 1910, Morecci was walking down Poydras Street when he was approached by two well-dressed men who pulled pistols out of their belts and fired 5 shots at him. 2 bullets struck Morecci in the head, and he fell to the pavement, seriously wounded, as the 2 men ran away in different directions. Morecci ended up surviving the attack, and when questioned by police, he claimed to have no idea who his assailants were. But it was generally understood that one of the shooters was Paul De Cristina, and that the other was a member of his faction named Giuseppe Di Martini. This apparent act of rebellion against Morecci was not to go unpunished. 1 month later, De Cristina was shot and killed on the street as he was entering his grocery saloon on the corner of Calliope and Howard Streets. His neighbor, another Italian grocer named Pietro Pipitone, admitted that he had fired the shot, claiming that De Cristina owed him 2 months' rent. But given the victim and the fact that the grocery trade was a favorite cover for Italian criminals, police thought there was more behind the killing. And when, 2 months later, Giuseppe Di Martini was also fatally shot, on Bourbon Street, by a man seen moments before in the company of Vincenzo Morecci, it was clear that this back-and-forth series of assassinations and assassination attempts bore all the earmarks of a mafia power struggle. Morecci was eventually acquitted of involvement in the Di Martini murder, but the killings went on, most of them involving Italian grocers who had allegedly been threatened by the Black Hand. In July of 1910, grocer Joseph Manzella, who had received several Black Hand extortion letters, was shot to death in his store by a man named Giuseppe Spanazio. In this case, there was a witness, Manzella's 17-year-old daughter Josephine, who grabbed a small revolver and chased the assailant into the street, where she shot him dead on the banquet. "I'm glad I killed him," the unrepentant girl told police. "If he had been arrested, he probably would have been set free within a few months." But then came a series of more mysterious murders that seemed fundamentally unlike those that had come before. They took place in the dead of night, for one thing, and in the privacy of the victims' bedrooms, rather than on the street or in their stores. In August of 1910, grocer John Crutti was brutally beaten with a meat cleaver as he lay sleeping with his wife and children in the residence behind their Royal Street home. Some months later, another grocer, Joseph Davi, was also butchered, again with a cleaver and again while in bed with his wife, who was injured but survived. In both cases, police had no leads and were able to make no arrests. Then, at 2 a.m. on the morning of May 16, 1912, an attack left yet another Italian grocer dead. Antonio Sciambra and his pregnant wife were asleep beside their young son in the bedroom of their home on a lonely stretch of Galvez Street. An assailant climbed through an unlocked kitchen window, made his way down the hallway, and entered the bedroom. As the victims slept, he lifted the mosquito netting over their bed, pressed the barrel of a pistol against the grocer's torso, and fired 5 shots. Sciambra died almost instantly, and his wife, who was struck by a bullet that had passed through her husband's body, was mortally wounded. She was able to crawl to a window and scream for help, but by the time a neighbor arrived, the shooter had escaped. Police were again baffled, but this time they at least had some clues. While moving 2 boxes to help him reach the kitchen window, the killer had left a clear footprint in the soft mud around the house's water cistern. The imprint was of a new shoe, and one of the latest and most stylish shape. Perhaps more important, a neighbor told police about an incident she had witnessed in the Sciambra grocery 2 weeks earlier. 2 Italian men, one of them tall and well-dressed, had walked into the establishment. "Good morning, Mrs. Tony," the tall man said to Mrs. Sciambra, a form of address that police would later recall when the mysterious Mrs. Tony chalk message was found in the Maggio axe murder investigation. Mr. Sciambra asked his wife to leave, and then argued with the 2 men in Italian for some time. The men finally left, according to the witness, with scowls on their faces. But when the district attorney tried to follow up on this suspicious incident, Mrs. Sciambra, who survived for some 10 days before succumbing to her bullet wound, was strangely uncooperative. "The Italians of New Orleans," the Daily Item reported in some dismay, "awed by the power of the Black Hand, fear the murderers will become more desperate. They ask, who will be next?" Assassinations of known mobsters on the street were one thing, but Sciambra, like Crutti and Davi, was apparently a legitimate business person, slaughtered in his bed as he lay beside his wife and child. Few in New Orleans had any hope that their police would get to the bottom of these crimes. As the Daily States observed a few days after the killing, "Many theories have been advanced, but the Sciambra outrage promises to be listed among the many mysterious cases which have never been solved." Helpless as they were to control crime in the Italian enclaves of the city, the New Orleans police were having better luck implementing the reformers' campaign to crack down on Storyville. The passage of 2 new laws significantly expanded the arsenal that could be brought to bear against the libertine practices of the Tenderloin. In 1910, the city council passed a bill amending the original Storyville ordinance, strengthening restrictions against lewd dances and brothels, and beefing up penalties for all other infractions. State laws passed that same year toughened the prohibition against interracial concubinage and other forms of contact across the color line. Though the state legislature declined to put a strict definition on the term colored, reformers like Philip Werlein hoped to use the new laws to put the Basin Street octoroon houses out of business for good. Meanwhile, gay shattuck was also being used more effectively as a weapon for reform. Shortly before Mardi Gras in 1911, Tom Anderson's persistent scourge, Dr. S.A. Smith, superintendent of Louisiana's Anti-Saloon League, launched a campaign against that most cherished of Storyville traditions, the French ball. On the day before Anderson's ball of the 2 well-known gentlemen, the district attorney, under heavy pressure from reformers, announced that the provisions of gay shattuck would be strictly enforced. In other words, if women were present at the ball, no liquor could be served, and vice versa. According to the announcement, no subterfuges would be tolerated. For once, the mayor of Storyville was effectively stymied. The day after the ball, the Daily Picayune's headline was triumphant: "Old carnival orgy curbed, with not a drink in sight." According to the paper's report, all attendees had been searched for contraband bottles and flasks as they entered Oddfellows Hall. And while the ball did go on, the atmosphere had been decidedly sober, or sadly lonesome, as the paper reported. Anderson's other bane, Reverend J. Benjamin Lawrence, could barely contain his glee. "Every lover of decency and morality," he told his congregation that Sunday, "could rejoice that these debauching revels will soon pass out of existence." But the hardest blow to Storyville would come 2 years later, in March of 1913, with the culmination of the so-called dance hall wars on Franklin Street. The Parker brothers had been gearing up for a confrontation for months beforehand, importing various thugs and mob enforcers from New York, ostensibly to work as waiters in the Tuxedo Dance Hall. Most hard-bitten of the lot was one Charles Harrison, known to police departments throughout the Northeast as Jip the Blood. An enforcer of some reputation, Harrison was fleeing a potential murder charge in New York when he showed up in Storyville and started working at the Tuxedo. And it was soon clear that the Parkers had hired him to do more than wait tables. In the early morning hours of Easter Monday, 1913, James Enright, a waiter at Billy Phillips's 102 Ranch, walked into the Tuxedo with two friends. Because of the Sunday closing law, there had been no music at the dance hall that night, but now that midnight was past, the Tuxedo's bar was apparently open for business. Enright, who resented the newly imported crop of servers at the Tuxedo, who were allegedly working for scab wages, got into an argument with the cashier. Harry Parker intervened, ejecting Enright and his friends and thrashing them soundly in the process. As he left the waiter lying in the street, Parker allegedly made some comments about his boss that were highly uncomplimentary to his character. When Phillips heard about the fight, he immediately headed over to the Tuxedo. Unarmed and still in his shirt sleeves, he walked into the bar and began verbally abusing the Parkers, berating them for their rough handling of his employee. A heated argument followed, but before matters could get out of hand, Phillips was dragged out of the dance hall by his friend and fellow saloonkeeper, Tony Battistina. Back at the 102 Ranch, Phillips apparently calmed down over the next few hours. By 4 a.m., when there was still plenty of action in Storyville, even on the morning after Easter, Phillips was feeling conciliatory. Still unarmed, he again walked across the street to the Tuxedo, with a number of friends and curious bystanders in his wake. The Parkers were still there, along with some customers and staff. Phillips stepped up to the bar and threw down a dollar bill. "Come on, give us a drink," he said. "We'll see about the fight later." At this point, Jip the Blood, who had slipped out of the establishment's back door at Phillips's reappearance, came in the Tuxedo's front door with a nickel-plated revolver in his hand. Creeping up behind Phillips, he thrust the barrel of the gun against the saloonkeeper's ribs. "Come on, you bastard," he said. "Let's have it out." Then he fired three or four shots into Phillips's torso at point-blank range. The ensuing melee of gunfire would prove to be impossible for police or the courts to sort out. 20 eyewitnesses would later testify to what happened, but there would be no meaningful consensus on who shot whom in the chaotic moments after Jip's assassination of Billy Phillips. Certainly, Harry and Charles Parker had both fired some shots, but others, never identified, probably friends of the victim, had clearly been firing back. When the gunfire finally ended, Phillips and Harry Parker were dead, while Jip the Blood, Charles Parker, and a black porter named Willie Henderson were wounded. Ultimately, only one person, Jip, a.k.a. Charles Harrison, would be tried for murder. But thanks to the highly contradictory nature of the eyewitness testimony, the case would end in a hung jury, allowing Harrison to go free. For the fate of Storyville, the night of the Tuxedo shooting would prove to be a decisive turning point. Respectable New Orleans had now officially had enough. In the wake of the Easter night melee, amid enormous public outrage, Superintendent of Police James Reynolds closed down all of Storyville on Monday. Some places would be allowed to reopen on Tuesday, but the dance halls were to remain shut indefinitely. "As long as the operators of these resorts were willing to conduct them properly," Reynolds told reporters, "the police had no objection, and the resorts were tolerated. But now that they have shown a disposition to operate outside of the law, it is evident that the public has become disgusted. I have determined to close all places where men and women of the underworld congregate in nightly orgies. The order was likely to hit the economy of Storyville hard, but Reynolds was unequivocal. At noon on Monday, March 24th, he issued an order to Captain Leroy of the 4th Precinct. You will at once take up all permits of dance halls in your precinct, send them to this office, and close up at once all such establishments in your precinct. The glory days of a wide-open and thriving Storyville, it seemed, were about to end. Chapter 14. Hard Times. In the months following the killings at the Tuxedo, the shuttering of the Storyville dance halls created a detrimental ripple effect that was felt throughout the district. With fewer customers coming to the Tenderloin to dance, and many others frightened away by the neighborhood's worsening reputation for crime and violence, businesses of all kinds suffered, and a much more staid and sedate atmosphere descended on Franklin Street. New Orleans seems to have put the kibosh on the bunny hug, grizzly bear, turkey trot, Texas Tommy, and other fastidious creations. The Daily Picayune reported in its March 30th edition, "In the place of the dance halls, which once did such tremendous business, cabarets have been effectively established, with tables and chairs taking up all the available space once used for dancing. Now, instead of noisy Negro bands, the low whining of half-tuned string instruments and the strumming of a piano are heard." This dampening of spirit was exacerbated by an increased police presence in and around the district, as well as a greater tendency among police to actually enforce the restrictions of Gay Shattuck and other laws. Sunday closing was no longer regarded as a mere suggestion, and cafes that used to employ a female singer were now forbidden to do so. Only one proprietor seemed immune to the stricter enforcements. "It is passing strange," one disgruntled competitor complained to the Picayune, "that Tom Anderson should be allowed to have women entertainers, and we are barred from having them. He is like the rest of us, except, of course, you know, he has a political pull, and they won't touch Tom. He's too strong." But even the all-powerful mayor of Storyville couldn't do much to halt the district's slide. In the months after the Parker Phillips shootout, the number of prostitutes working in the Tenderloin slipped to just 700. Lulu White's Mahogany Hall began employing only 8 women regularly, while half of the cribs on Villery and Robertson Streets became vacant. Meanwhile, prices were being cut all along Basin Street. By 1916, the cost of a 15-minute romp at Josie Arlington's Palace had fallen to $1 even. The city's musicians were feeling the pinch as well. Jazz bands reduced the number of players in their rosters, replacing their guitarist, bassist, and violinist with a single pianist to back up soloists. With fewer gigs available, many jazzmen were forced to go back to their day jobs. Even after the dance halls reopened in 1914, when New Orleans caught the tango fever that had swept through much of the country, behavior in the halls was tightly controlled. In the so-called Tango Belt, a stretch of Rampart Street in the French Quarter where many of the district's dance halls had moved, Superintendent Reynolds announced strict prohibitions on all vulgar forms of the dance, insisting that there be daylight between the dancers and no lewd snake wriggling of the shoulders and hips. Violators were promptly arrested, sometimes in droves. The effect on the city's nightlife was sobering. According to the item, Reynolds had closed down the lid so tight in the belt that the music was no more than a dirge for the gaiety departed, and a lot of young men in New Orleans were keeping their money out of the beer pots and wassail bowls. Some musicians, responding to the worsening employment picture, began to look for opportunities elsewhere. Several members of the Tuxedo Dance Hall Band, including Freddie Keppard and George Baquet, reorganized as the nucleus of a new group called the Original Creole Band. In August of 1914, under the leadership of bassist Bill Johnson, they left New Orleans and began touring the vaudeville circuit, ending with an extended stay in Los Angeles. Others followed their lead over the next few years. Jelly Roll Morton, for instance, who had already been spending much of his time on the road, began finding new opportunities and more receptive audiences in Chicago, New York, and California. White bands also began heeding the call from other cities. In late 1914, the vaudeville dance team of Frisco and McDermott performed in New Orleans. After their show, they stopped by the Club Creole and heard a white jazz band led by trombonist Tom Brown. "Boy, listen to that music. What a band," Loretta McDermott allegedly told her partner. "Come on, Joe, let's go. What rhythm?" They found the band's loose, syncopated beat ideal for their style of dancing. According to jazz legend, when they returned to Chicago, they convinced the owner of Lamb's Cafe in the Loop to bring the band north. And although accounts differ on the details, what's known for sure is that Tom Brown's band left New Orleans in May of 1915 with a 6-week contract to play at Lamb's. They were an instant hit, and soon the exciting new music from New Orleans, which was finally being referred to by the name Jass or Jazz, was revolutionizing the sound of popular entertainment in the Second City. Another white New Orleans band went north a few months later. In December of 1915, Nick LaRocca, the cornetist whose disapproving father had destroyed his first two instruments with an axe, was playing in one of Jack Lane's ballyhoo bands at the corner of Canal and Royal, advertising a prize fight. A visiting Chicago cafe owner named Harry James heard them and was deeply impressed by the young man pointing his cornet skyward and blowing to the point of apoplexy. James approached Lane afterward and asked if he might be interested in taking his band north to Chicago. Lane claimed that he was too busy, but he advised James to go hear LaRocca perform that night at the Haymarket Cafe with another band, led by drummer Johnny Stein. The Chicagoan liked what he heard there, too, and soon Stein's Dixie Jazz Band had a contract to open the Boosters Club in Chicago in early 1916. Word was getting out, and the diaspora of the Crescent City's musical talent was now underway. Not that those who remained behind were entirely idle. In some cases, the emigration of talent just meant a reshuffling of personnel in existing bands. When Keppard and Baquet decamped to California, for instance, their places in the popular New Olympia band were soon filled by Joe Oliver and Sidney Bechet. And there was always a new crop of younger jazzmen to fill the artistic vacuum. Trombonist Kid Ory, whose band was now playing full-time in the city after their move from Laplace, was proving to be especially popular, not only among black audiences, but also among many young whites, who liked their more polished style of jazz. Once, at a gig for whites at the Gymnasium, Ory's band played opposite one of John Robichaud's more established straight ensembles and earned a larger share of the applause. Afterward, Robichaud offered Ory a job, saying, "I like the way you play." "I like the way you play, too," Ory replied smartly, "but I'm not going to break up my band. It's too late. You had your day." Ory was apparently much more impressed by a certain child cornetist from the Colored Waifs Home brass band, whom everyone in town had been talking about. Ory first heard Little Louis Armstrong at the Labor Day Parade in late 1913, and he couldn't believe that such a young boy could be so accomplished a player. "You're doing a good job," Ory told him at the parade. "You're going to be all right someday. You keep that up." For Armstrong, this praise from one of New Orleans' top jazzmen was utterly thrilling. The boy had had no easy time of it during his stay at the Waifs' home, at least in the beginning, before he'd made the adjustment from life on the streets. The home, which housed some 200 inmates, was run with strict military discipline, and the kid from Black Storyville was identified early on as a boy with a bad stamp. But somehow, the regimen of army-style drilling and regular stints on cleaning and gardening crews spoke to the boy's need for structure and discipline. Soon he was thriving in the new atmosphere, where his innate good-heartedness and natural skill as a clown made him popular among the other boys. From the beginning of his sentence, Louis had yearned to join the home's brass band. Unfortunately, this meant convincing the band's leader, Peter Davis, that he was worthy of belonging. "Davis didn't like me too much at first," Armstrong later admitted. But the boy was conscientious and eager to please, and eventually the band leader softened toward him. First, Davis allowed Louis to play the tambourine with the group. From there, the boy graduated to the snare drum. Eventually, he was entrusted with an old bugle to wake the other boys with a reveille every morning. Finally, Davis gave the boy a cornet and taught him to play Home Sweet Home. Under Davis's careful tutelage, Louis picked up the cornet with amazing facility. By the summer of 1913, he was already leading the band, which frequently was hired for gigs on the outside, at parades, private parties, and picnics at Spanish Fort and the other lake resorts. Here, Armstrong heard, and was heard by, some of the best musicians in the city. The ubiquity of music in the Crescent City began to work its magic on the boy, who would later recall lying on his bunk on Sunday evenings, smelling the honeysuckle outside, and listening to a jazz band playing for some rich white folks about half a mile away. "Me and music got married at the home," he would later say. "I do believe that my whole success goes back to that time I was arrested as a wayward boy." Sometime in the summer of 1914, Armstrong's father persuaded the juvenile court to release Louis into his custody. The boy didn't want to leave the waif's home, especially not to go live with his unloved and unloving father. And when it turned out that Willie Armstrong wanted his son around only as long as he worked more than he ate, Louis moved out. The boy took up residence again with his mother, May Ann, and sister, Mama Lucy, on Perdido Street, in "that great big room," as he later put it, "where the three of us were so happy." Faced with the necessity of helping support the household, Louis immediately found work hauling coal on a mule-drawn coal cart for 15 cents a load. But what he really wanted to do was play his horn. After performing for so long with simple, pimply-faced boys at the home, he was eager to learn something from the real pros. His first day back at Mayans, he ran into an old friend, Cocaine Buddy, who tipped him off to a job at Henry Ponce's Honky Tonk in the neighborhood. "All you have to do," Buddy explained, "is to put on your long pants and play the blues for the whores that hustle all night. They will call you sweet names and buy you drinks and give you tips." Louis was hired immediately, and soon he was bringing in as much money with his cornet as he was with his coal shovel. Early on, he found a musical mentor in the person of Joe Oliver. To Louis's mind, Oliver was the best horn player in New Orleans. "Better than Bolden, better than Bunk Johnson." Louis began shadowing his idol all over, second lining behind him in parades, and sometimes holding his cornet between numbers. When delivering stone coal to a crib prostitute in the district, Louis would become entranced by the sound of Oliver's horn coming from Pete Lala's next door. "I'd just stand there in that lady's crib listening to King Oliver," he later wrote. "All of a sudden it would dawn on that lady that I was still in her crib, very silent, while she hustled those tricks, and she'd say, 'What's the matter with you, boy? This is no place to daydream. I've got work to do.'" But Louis didn't mind the scolding. "As long as Oliver was blowing," he said, "that was who I wanted to hear, at any chance I got." Oliver started taking a special interest in his young disciple and began to give him cornet lessons. He also frequently invited the boy over to his house, where Mrs. Oliver would stuff him with that New Orleans staple, red beans and rice. "Which I loved," said Armstrong. Oliver even gave Louis one of his old horns, a beat-up York cornet that the boy accepted with unctuous gratitude. "I always knew, if I'm going to get a little break in this game," he later recalled, "it was going to be through Papa Joe, nobody else." But Louis was already playing well enough to make his own breaks. One evening, shortly after his discharge from the waif's home, Black Benny Williams, an enormous and notoriously combative bass drum player from the neighborhood, took him to hear Kid Ory headlining at National Park. The real star of the night, however, proved to be Armstrong himself. "Benny asked me if I wouldn't let Louis sit in with my band," Ory recalled years later. "I remembered the kid from the Labor Day street parade, and I gladly agreed. Louis came up and played Ole Miss and the Blues, and everyone in the park went wild over this boy in knee trousers who could play so great." Ory was so impressed that he urged the young horn player to sit in with the band any time he wanted to. "Louis came several times to different places where I worked, and we really got to know each other," Ory said. "He always came accompanied by Benny, the drummer. In the crowded places, Benny would handcuff Louis to himself with a handkerchief so Louis wouldn't get lost." Black Benny grew so proud of his little protege that the drummer was soon singing his praises to anyone who'd listen. You think you can play, he told Sidney Bechet when the two met one day. But I know a little boy right around the corner from my place. He can play high society better than you. Intrigued, and likely a little put out, accustomed as he was to being regarded as the local wunderkind himself, Bechet said, Well, I'd like to see that boy. So they arranged to go hear him play. It was Louis, Bechet explained in his autobiography, and I'll be doggone if he didn't play high society on the cornet. The tune was very hard for clarinet to do, and really unthinkable for cornet to do at those times. But Louis, he did it. Bechet had, of course, already heard Armstrong sing, but this was the first time he'd listened to the boy play cornet, and he was amazed at the quick progress Louis had made on the instrument. So he hired Armstrong to play with him and a drummer on a little advertising gig he'd set up to promote a show at the Ivory Theater. The drummer and Louis were paid 50 cents each. Bechet kept a dollar for himself. But there were no hard feelings, apparently. We went out afterward and bought some beer with the money and got those sandwiches. Poor boys, they're called, Bechet recalled. We really had good times. Even so, the two recognized each other as rivals. And as Bechet's biographer points out, for the rest of their lives, the two geniuses of early jazz treated each other with the utmost caution. That little Louis had Benny as a protector was fortunate, since New Orleans in the teens had become a very dangerous place, particularly for black musicians playing in low-down dives and on the increasingly perilous streets. Sometimes the problem was just low-level harassment on the parade routes. All the bands wanted Benny to play the bass drum in parades, Armstrong recalled. Anytime anybody give us kids trouble, Benny'd hit 'em over the head with the drum mallets. But often, the violence could be life-threatening. Despite the newly beefed-up police presence in the city's entertainment districts, shootings and knife fights between rival miscreants remained common, and musicians were often caught in the crossfire. Our bandstand was right by the door, Armstrong wrote of one tonk he played at, and if somebody starts shooting, I don't see how I didn't get hit. Sometimes the calls were very close indeed. One night in 1915 at Pete Lala's, Bechet and Oliver were enjoying a drink at the bar when a customer was shot dead right in front of their eyes. Little Louis himself had a harrowing experience on a Sunday morning at Henry Ponce's. Armstrong was talking with the owner in the doorway of the tonk when he noticed several men, apparently friends of Ponce's rival, Joe Segretta, gathering in front of the grocery across the street. All of a sudden, I saw one of them pull out his gun and point it at us, Armstrong remembered. Their shots missed Ponce, at which point the club owner pulled out his own revolver and started pursuing the shooters, firing as he ran. But Armstrong just stood there in fright. I had not moved, he later recalled, and the flock of bystanders who saw me riveted to the sidewalk rushed up to me. Were you hit? They asked. Are you hurt? When they asked me what they did, I fainted. I thought the first shot had hit me. The racial atmosphere of the city was also growing more volatile in the mid-teens. Often police would have to break up parades to prevent violent confrontations between black and white spectators and participants. Sometimes the police themselves were the aggressors. Lots of times the both races looked like they were going to get into a scrap over just nothing much, Armstrong wrote about those years. And even if the colored are in the right, when the cops arrive, they'll whip your head and then ask questions. For the city's black jazzmen, the situation in New Orleans, despite the growing popularity of their music among young whites, was becoming untenable, and the possibilities elsewhere ever more tempting. More and more of them were seriously considering the offers of jobs outside of New Orleans. People were hearing a lot of excitement about what was happening up north, Bechet said of this time, and I had this idea in my head that I was to see other places. We'd heard all about how the North was freer, and we were wanting to go real bad. Up on Esplanade Avenue, far from the ongoing turmoil in black and white Storyville, retired Madame Josie Arlington had fallen gravely ill. Sometime in early 1913, right around the time of the Tuxedo shootings, she had taken to her bed and had been declining ever since. By autumn, she was experiencing periods of delirium and had lost control of her bladder and her bowels. Whether this was a case of late-stage syphilis or some other disease is unknown. She was only 49 years old, but Josie Arlington had led a difficult and presumably unhygienic existence for much of her life, despite the luxury and ease she had more recently enjoyed as Mrs. Mary Dubler Brady. Anna Dubler, now 29, was her aunt's principal caregiver. According to the testimony of family friends, the two were still absolutely devoted to each other, and while there were others in the house to help, Anna's mother, her aunt's cousin Margaret, a nurse named Mrs. Jackson, and a family friend named Mrs. Walker, it was Anna who was mainly responsible for looking after the invalid. Once she even injured herself while trying to lift her now rather stout aunt from her bed. It was hard work for the slender young woman, but apparently Anna felt it was the least she could do for the person solely responsible for giving her the comfortable, respectable life she had enjoyed since birth. Sometime in November of 1913, her Aunt Mary became more forthcoming about her past.
"Little girl," she said one day when the two were alone, "how I have been fooling you."
She explained that she wanted Anna to help her write a book about her life.
A book for the protection of young women.
Anna was confused at first, but then, in a rush of confession, her aunt revealed everything. She told her all about her former life as a prostitute and then as Josie Arlington, queen of the demimonde, the famous Madam of Basin Street. She also revealed that she and Uncle Tom had never been married, that even Cousin Margaret had once been a prostitute, and that Margaret's son, Anna's own cousin Thomas, was a bastard, born in Josie's first brothel on Custom House Street. Anna, understandably, was appalled. She ran out of the bedroom, found her Uncle Tom, and asked him whether any of this was really true.
"Child," Brady said, "go back to Auntie and pay no attention. You know she is delirious."
But then Anna asked Mrs. Walker, who reluctantly confirmed everything.
"My God," the older woman lamented, "how much would Auntie not have given to spare you this?"
Frantic, Anna went back to Brady and asked again if the story was true. Brady felt he could lie no longer.
"Yes," he said finally. "I'm sorry to say, it's true."
This sudden revelation was simply horrible, Anna would later say. She seemed especially upset by the fact that the whole family had been aware of the truth and hadn't told her.
"My father knew it, my brothers and my mother knew of the existing circumstances, and they countenanced it," she said, "but I didn't."
In a state of high dudgeon now, she demanded that Brady turn over all of her jewelry,
"because I didn't intend to live under the roof where such things existed."
The irony was stark. Having taken great pains over the years to turn this day laborer's daughter into a refined young woman, the Bradys were now going to have to suffer the consequences of her impeccable middle-class scruples. Eventually, however, the impressionable and pliable young woman was mollified. Perhaps realizing that she had absolutely nowhere else to go, she gradually allowed herself to be talked out of leaving. Her beloved aunt needed her, no matter what her history or current living situation, and all of her immediate family lived in that capacious house on Esplanade, a place where she had felt happy and cared for. So she did not run away after all. She decided simply to continue going on as she had before, nursing her lifelong benefactor amid the comforts and luxuries she had long ago become accustomed to. But Miss Mary Dubler, for now she could be known by her real name, just grew sicker, and when it became clear that the matriarch was not going to recover from her illness, it occurred to Anna's parents that the future of their family was hardly assured. Mary Dubler had always been secretive and rather grudging about her financial affairs. "Miss Dubler was a very tight proposition," as Tom Brady would later put it, and the contents of her will were unknown. Dubler had told several friends that she intended to leave her entire estate to Anna, but in early 1913 she had signed papers to transfer ownership of the Esplanade mansion to Brady, ostensibly in exchange for $25,000 in cash that Brady had given her at various times during the last 20 years. Worried that the ailing woman might also have left the rest of her estate to her longtime inamorato, Anna's mother began to concoct a plan whereby the Dubler family might ensure their future prosperity. One day in late 1913 or early 1914, she broached a sensitive topic with her daughter. "Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing," she said, "if Anna were to marry Tom Brady after Aunt Mary died? That way she would guarantee that everyone could continue to live together in the Esplanade house, as one extended family, the way they had been living until now." Anna at first found the whole idea outrageous. Could it be that her mother actually wanted her to marry the man she had regarded as an uncle for her entire life? A man 21 years her senior? The man who had been living and sleeping with her dear aunt for well over a decade? One can certainly understand the young woman's initial aversion to the proposal. Tom Brady apparently had no objection to it. But Anna, sheltered as she had been all her life, and perhaps intimidated by the prospect of facing the world without the bulwark of her aunt's fortune, was susceptible to persuasion. Over the next weeks, she talked with other members of the household about it. "Mrs. Jackson," Anna said to the nurse one day, "isn't it awful? They are talking about me marrying Mr. Brady as soon as Auntie dies." Mrs. Jackson confessed to being surprised, but didn't necessarily think the idea was all that awful. "Mr. Brady can do you no good, but you can do Mr. Brady a world of good," she said. "You cannot take Mr. Brady from the sphere he has been in and raise him to your level, but you can do him a world of good." Mrs. Jackson also agreed with Anna's mother that the marriage would keep the family together and make it respectable for all of them to be living together under one roof. The two priests Anna then consulted also saw wisdom in the plan. Father Ansel Maynor and Father Philip Murphy both felt that, under the circumstances, Anna would protect herself from scandal by marrying Brady. "If you love him and he loves you," Father Murphy said, somewhat disingenuously perhaps, "I think it is the best thing to do." Eventually, Anna was convinced that she needed a protector and that Brady would serve admirably. "I needed someone who would guide me," she later explained, "and since Mr. Brady, all during my childhood, had shielded me and protected me, I thought he was the one most capable of doing it." At 6 p.m. on February 14, 1914, Valentine's Day, appropriately enough, Mary Dubler, a.k.a. Josie Arlington, a.k.a. Mrs. Thomas Brady, died 8 days before her 50th birthday. Her funeral that Sunday was an elaborate affair, with a line of flower-freighted carriages winding from the Esplanade House to nearby St. Boniface Church, where the service was conducted by Fathers Maynor and Murphy. In attendance were many members of New Orleans' political and sporting circles, including, of course, Tom Anderson, her longtime friend and business partner. But as the Daily Item pointed out, though her life had been spent among the women of the demi-monde, none attended the funeral. The only homage received at the hands of her companions were wreaths of flowers sent to the home and laid upon the tomb. Exactly 1 week after Mary Dubler's death, Anna Dubler and John Thomas Brady were married at their home on Esplanade, with Tom Anderson again in attendance. Anna's father, Henry, who later claimed that he was presented with the marriage plan as a fait accompli, was not happy, and he apparently showed up at the ceremony quite drunk. But he was eventually persuaded to give his daughter away at the appropriate time. "Take her, Tom," he allegedly said to the groom. "You helped spoil her. Now take your own medicine." Mary Dubler's will had been read the day before, after a locksmith broke open the safe whose combination had gone with the deceased to her grave. In that document, dated June 29, 1903, Mary Dubler left small bequests to her brother Henry, her cousin Margaret, and their children. But everything else, including the brothel on Basin Street, went to Anna, and so to Tom Brady as well. The will, however, would not go uncontested. 3 weeks later, Henry Dubler, claiming that he was done up in this deal between Brady and his daughter, would file suit to nullify not just the will, but also the earlier transfer of the Esplanade mansion to Brady. Apparently, the prospect of having a wealthy daughter was not enough for the man. He wanted his fair share of his sister's treasure. He did not win his challenge, however, and the estate eventually went as dictated to the new Mrs. Brady. She and her aging husband went on to enjoy a seemingly happy marriage that soon produced two children, But the Bradys apparently spent through Mary Dubler's fortune quite rapidly. By 1918, they were already being sued by their old friend Tom Anderson for failure to pay back some loans he had guaranteed for them. High moral standards, it would seem, could be very expensive to uphold. In the meantime, Storyville had lost its reluctant queen. And on the very same day as her death, the district had suffered another blow. The Daily Item published a pointed editorial that day under the title No Necessary Evil. In it, the paper expressed the city's growing discontent with the whole idea on which Storyville had been predicated, that prostitution and vice were necessary evils that could safely be segregated and regulated rather than prohibited. Segregation of immoral women has always failed, the paper contended. The result has been a worldwide awakening to the fact that the wages of sin is death, and that the welfare of the race is threatened by the widespread indulgence in vice. The message was clear. Just putting the lid on vice in New Orleans was no longer enough. The campaign to abolish the segregated district entirely would now begin in earnest.